From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Republicans have unveiled their tax cut plan. It cuts the corporate tax rate, reduces the number of tax brackets for individuals, and doesn't make any changes to 401k retirement accounts. House Ways and Means Chairman Kevin Brady said today there were some who didn't think Republicans would be able to agree on the details.
Now, working together with President Trump, our colleagues in the House and Senate, and you, the American people, we're going to prove them wrong once and for all by getting pro-growth tax reform to the president's desk this year.
Joining us now is NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, what more do we know about the tax proposal?
Well, Jeremy, one new wrinkle is that this plan would leave intact the top tax rate of 39.6% for individuals making $500,000 or couples making $1 million or more. That is one way to address the complaint that the original draft was too skewed towards the wealthy. Also, well, as you mentioned, the tax break for 401k retirement savings was left intact in this measure. It does make a tweak to the mortgage interest deduction tax break, which was, we thought, off the table. Initially, that was one of the tax breaks that the White House had promised would not be touched. But this plan would cap the deductible mortgage interest at $500,000. That's down from $1 million today. And also bar deduction on mortgage interest for second homes or home equity loans going forward.
It would also end the estate tax, which Republicans like to call the death tax, which was a controversial issue.
And that will remain controversial because the estate tax is paid only by the very top wealthiest families in the country. That, along with the elimination of the alternative minimum tax, mean that many of the savings from this tax bill would still go to those at the top of the income and wealth ladders.
And Republicans bowed to pressure from lawmakers in high-tax states like New York. People there will still be able to deduct some of their state and local taxes?
They kind of half-bowed. Remember, when the budget went through the House on a sort of necessary precursor to this tax bill, there were 11 Republicans from New York and New Jersey who voted against the GOP budget to protest the idea that the very valuable tax break for state and local income taxes would be eliminated. In an effort to mollify those Republicans from high-tax states like New York, New Jersey, California, Illinois, this plan would allow taxpayers to deduct up to $10,000 in property taxes. But the tax break for state and local taxes still goes away in this bill, and that will continue to be controversial.
So what happens now?
Well, there's going to be a sales pitch here at the White House this afternoon. Republicans are very determined to push this bill through. They'd like to get it done by the end of the year to sort of cap off a year in which they don't have a whole lot of other legislative accomplishments to showcase. But this is still going to be a heavy lift. There will still be complaints from Democrats and those on the left that this measure is overly weighted towards the wealthy. And the real challenge is, in their zeal to cut both individual and corporate taxes, Republicans are taking trillions of dollars out of the federal treasury. And they're not cutting very much in the way of loopholes and tax breaks to help pay for that. So that's going to be the challenge.
All right. Well, we will keep watching that. But meanwhile, President Trump heads off on a trip to Asia tomorrow, his first official trip there. He's going to visit five countries, attend two international summits. Do you think North Korea is going to dominate this trip or a range of issues?
North Korea will certainly dominate at least the first two stops in Tokyo and Seoul. Both Japan and South Korea are obviously very concerned about the nuclear saber-rattling by North Korea. Some of the North Korean missile tests have flown right over Japanese territory. So that will certainly be a focus there, as well as the third stop in China. In China, though, the president will also be talking about the trade deficit with China that the U.S. has, which was a source of frequent complaints for him during the presidential campaign. Mm-hmm. He has said that he would take a softer line on China's trade policies if China cooperates in putting pressure on North Korea over its nuclear program. But I think those are going to be the twin issues that dominate at least the first three stops on this trip, North Korea and trade.
Well, and what about the relationship between President Trump and China right now? President Xi Jinping just spoke recently at the Party Congress and said it's time for China to take center stage in the world. Experts are saying Xi is the most powerful Chinese leader since Mao.
And it's interesting to contrast both his position and that of Japanese Prime Minister Abe, who's also coming off a big electoral win, with the position of President Trump, who is going in a somewhat weakened state with his own approval ratings at their near low point for his presidency, and, of course, with his former campaign chairman now under indictment back home.
And this is a pretty long trip, right? 12 days?
It's going to be a marathon. It's the longest trip by a president to Asia since the Bushushuru trip in 1992, and we remember how that ended rather embarrassingly for the first president, George H.W. Bush.
That's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Yes, that president got very sick on that trip. Well, yesterday, President Trump tweeted that the accused terrorist who killed 8 people in New York should get death penalty, all caps. And after Saifullah Saipov was charged and read his rights in a federal court, the president was asked if he should go to Guantanamo Bay Prison in Cuba instead.
Are you considering that now, sir?
I would certainly consider that. Are you? Send him to Gitmo. I would certainly consider that, yes.
Josh Blackman is a constitutional law professor at South Texas College of Law in Houston. He joins us by Skype. Josh, the president calling for the death penalty, what's the impact there?
So as a general matter, it's a bad idea when people on the chain of command of a prosecution, such as the president, influence the proceedings by saying, here's what should happen. Generally, that's a decision that's made through a very formal process. And in no sense has that process been completed. In fact, the guy was only charged yesterday.
Well, can his legal team say that he can't get a fair trial because the president of the United States says he should get the death penalty?
They're going to try. In the military, there's a concept known as unlawful command influence. And this is when a commanding officer prejudices the outcome of a proceeding. This is especially a risky concern in the military because the judge is a member of the military and the jurors are a member of the military. So there's a risk when everyone's on the same team. What I suspect the Trump administration will argue is that this doctrine of unlawful command influence doesn't apply in the civilian context. We have independent judges, and during the selection of the jury, you make sure people haven't heard any statements that could prejudice them.
Well, in fact, even in the military, it might not always work. The lawyers for Bo Bergdahl, who deserted his base in Afghanistan, argued that then-candidate Trump's comments that Bergdahl was a traitor would make any trial for him unfair. They were unsuccessful in that. But you've also told us that you have another concern about this case in New York having to do with the prosecutor's office.
Right. A few months ago, President Trump fired the U.S. attorneys who were responsible for prosecuting crimes across the country. And one of the more famous people he fired was Preet Bharara, who was the United States attorney for the Southern District of New York. And as far as I know, Trump is personally interviewing people to fill that position. So now, whoever gets picked for this position will probably ask, what's your position on this terrorist attack? Will you seek the death penalty? So it creates an even another influence on this case because the vacancy is still apparent.
Yeah. Look, the president also said he'd consider Gitmo for speedier action against the accused. But then he tweeted today, would love to send the NYC terrorist to Guantanamo, but statistically that process takes much longer than going through the federal system. And we had a reminder of that yesterday. A judge at Guantanamo fined a chief defense counsel, this is a general, $1,000, and sentenced him to 21 days in confinement. Because this chief defense counsel, a general, wouldn't rescind the dismissal of 3 civilian lawyers in a case there. And those lawyers had wanted to quit over ethical questions they had about the trial, and instead he dismissed them. It sounds like kind of a mess there.
It truly is. If you think that sending someone to Guantanamo Bay will create speedy justice, you're wrong. There have been people who've been held there for over 15 years. So I think in all respects, trying the terrorist in New York in the federal court system, domestic courts, would be far more speedy than sending him down to Guantanamo.
What about the president's comments about the U.S. justice system, supposedly, you know, held up as one of the best in the world? Let's listen.
We need quick justice and we need strong justice, much quicker and much stronger than we have right now. Because what we have right now is a joke, and it's a laughingstock.
You know, aside from, you know, that being a comment on the U.S. justice system, does that ever play into the hands of a defense attorney?
Well, I think the president's comments here are really unfortunate. We have in the United States the greatest justice system in the world, and I will take slow and deliberate over speedy and irregular any time. The president has free speech rights like anyone else, so he can say what he wishes. But I do think they have very negative impacts when presidents do these sorts of things. But more broadly, you can bet the defense team is writing down every one of President Trump's tweets. The latest innovation in litigation is tweets. We just look what the president tweets, and that makes the proceeding unfair. I don't know if these last statements will hurt the prosecution here, but I do think they have broader implications for the separation of powers.
Will be quite something if an attorney gets up in an American courtroom and says this trial should be struck because the president of the United States himself said it's a joke and a laughingstock. Josh Blackman, constitutional law professor at South Texas College of Law in Houston. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You may know actor Dennis Leary from his hit FX show Rescue Me. He played a New York firefighter struggling with having survived 9/11 when so many didn't. Here he talks with his buddies about drinking.
I drank the way a man is supposed to drink. I drank in dark bars, dive bars, with other men, where the bartenders were men. It's like drinking in a cave. It's pretty much how I ended up drinking at home.
Rescue Me was inspired by the events of 9/11, and for Dennis, by his own firefighter cousin dying in an infamous 1999 warehouse fire in Worcester, Massachusetts, where they both grew up. Dennis became the force behind fundraisers for firefighters' families. Through his friend, Boston Bruin hockey great Cam Neely, he organized an annual comedy event to fight cancer. Well, now Dennis Leary wants to help the entire country, and a warning, in talking about how we're going to use a word still banned in many homes, my late mother would not approve. Dennis Leary has a new book out, Why We Don't Suck, a sequel to his 2009 Why We Suck, a feel-good guide to staying fat, loud, lazy, and stupid. We can't read you the subtitle of his new book. In fact, we can't read you very much of his new book because it's so expletive-laden. In fact, thank you and goodbye. Actually, when not hammering everyone across the political spectrum, Dennis takes some time in his new book to take a thoughtful look at what does make America great. And Dennis Leary joins us now. Dennis, welcome.
Hey.
So what should we talk about? Because we can't talk about the chapter about what parts of the country use the F-bomb more.
Oh, yes.
No, we can't.
It's funny that you bring up the cursing chapter because in the course of writing the book, I came across a study that was done by a professor, Jack Grieve, who lives in England and studies changes in words and trends. And he had maps that showed the 8 most common curse words in America and how where and how they were used. So we have a lot of words in common. Even though we may live in different parts of the country, and even though you may have voted for Trump and somebody else may have voted for Hillary Clinton, we all share the common curse
words. And your point is, why can't we all just get along? And you take on everybody, Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, because what? I mean, what are you saying here?
Well, the book started because my Democratic friends have lost their sense of humor. They spend their time rage-tweeting about Republicans. My Republican friends have lost their sense of humor. They spend their time, you know, bash-tweeting back at Democrats. My Republican friends, bow down to Hannity. My Democratic friends think that Rachel Maddow is the Virgin Mother. It's insane. And nobody's listening to anybody else. So I said, you know what? I want to write a book that just makes everybody hopefully laugh about the entire election, and also the state we find America in, whether it's racism, sexism, gun control. I wanted to actually hopefully make people laugh and make us realize there is a common ground.
You're throwing out one-liners, but then you also settle on these biographies of people who, you know, we really should be reminded about because we all do love them. Cam Neely and his Cancer Foundation, Michael J. Fox, who, of course, is battling Parkinson's. He plays hockey with you. You guys are vacationing together with your families, and you say he's in really great shape. What are you doing for cardio? And he says, I'm doing a lot of shaking. It's called the Parkinson's workout. But, you know, he give us the thumbnail. Why Michael J. Fox?
First of all, he's one of the funniest people I've ever known in my life. But, yeah, it's not a surprise to people at this point to say that he is a shockingly amazing guy who, you know, once he was diagnosed, and he certainly, you know, he had his moments when he was first diagnosed of not wanting to accept it as anybody would. And then he decided to sort of turn his life over to this sort of optimistic approach to accepting his disease and trying to go out and cure it and maybe change other people's lives who were suffering from it as well. You know, he's raised hundreds of millions of dollars for that cause. And I mean, he wrote a book about optimism, okay? Mm-hmm. While he was writing that book, he had some writer's block while he was writing his optimism book. And he, you know, it's one of my favorite Mike Fox moments. He walked into the kitchen and he was slamming stuff around and his wife said, "What the hell's wrong with you?" And he said, "I'm never going to finish my book on optimism." And so she just started laughing at him. And he was like, I got it. So he's an amazing human being. I met Cam Neely through him. They were both from Vancouver, British Columbia in Canada. And Cam came to Boston to become a member of the Boston Bruins. And I met Cam. You know, Cam turned to charity work after both of his parents died from cancer, very close together, you know, while he was still playing. And so he decided to turn his star power and his celebrity as a Hockey Hall of Famer into this great cause, the Cam Neely Cancer Foundation, to try to save lives. Those two people are very valuable to me because when my cousin died, I already had these two people in my life who had taken horrible events and turned them into something positive.
And well, let's just remind people of this terrible day. Your cousin and another firefighter ran into this warehouse, the fire set by some homeless people who'd fled, but people thought they were still there. They ran in to try to get them. All hell broke loose. Ceilings collapsed. Other firefighters ran in to get them. All six perished. Terrible, terrible story. And you started doing what?
We just wanted to help out the widows and the kids left behind. And from there, you know, a good friend of mine named Terry Quinn had become a firefighter in New York around the same time Jerry Lucy, my cousin, became a firefighter in Worcester when we were young. And so I was tied into a bunch of firefighters in New York because when you have a firefighter who's a friend of yours or a family member, their crew sort of gets moved into your life as well. Mm. So after 9/11, Terry Quinn said, "We're going to bring your foundation to New York and I'm going to help you. We're going to raise money to help the families, and then we're going to help out the FDNY," because one of the things they didn't have in New York, even though they have a great training facility, they didn't have a high-rise simulator. They didn't have something to simulate the events that happened on 9/11. So my name gets connected to a lot of this stuff, but really the credit goes to these people. All I am is the famous face. There's so many people, you know, that really, from Terry Quinn and other firefighters that helped me in New York to the Worcester Fire Department that helped me, you know, set up my foundation and to help the Worcester families and stuff. So I'm not taking credit. I'm just pointing people towards the causes.
Right. And also, in you know, pointing people to why we don't suck, because we have those great causes.
I mean, that's
and
the
do
other
that.
Thing. Like, I couldn't honestly, I cannot tell you. When I'm raising money, you know, when I'm working with the FDNY Foundation to raise money along with my foundation, or I'm working with the Worcester Fire Department, the last thing that comes up is anybody's political backing. You would know if they were a Red Sox or a Yankee fan before you would know if they were Republican or Democrat, because the job that they do, you know, Mike Fox doesn't care what political party you voted for. He just wants your money to help save lives, you know?
Well, I just want to say, Dennis Leary, you mentioned your famous face, and you are known from films. Your voice is known. You know, kids know your voice from children's films. But it's actually not that famous sometimes, because you have a whole chapter devoted to the people you're mistaken for. Kevin Bacon, Willem Dafoe, Beyonce mistook you for Bryan Adams right in front of your own daughter you were trying to impress. But people walk up to you and mistake you for Ellen DeGeneres?
Yes. Listen, let me tell you something, okay? People love me. And like when I'm walking around in public, it happened to me today when I'm walking around the airport. People, they're walking and they see me and they start smiling. You know why? Because they think I'm somebody else. So it's
John Bon Jovi.
I'm telling you, people love Bon Jovi. They love Kevin Bacon. They adore Ellen and Jane Lynch.
Jane Lynch. They think you're Jane Lynch.
Jane Lynch. And you know, it's like, sometimes it depends on the haircut. Like with Jane.
Jane Lynch, Coach Sue Sylvester in Glee.
I got mistaken for her. I was playing a character on a show on FX called Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll, and I had a shag haircut. I was wearing Jackie Onassis sunglasses. I had a woman's blouse on because I was playing a failed rock star, and I had a lot of jewelry on. And this woman, you know, asked me if she could take a picture. She was like watching us film, and I said, sure. And she took the picture, and as she was flagging down a cab, she said, "Oh my God, Glee's my favorite show, and you're my favorite character." And I was like, what? And when she got in the cab, I looked in this plate glass window, and I was like, I look like Jane Marie Lynch. And in Ellen's case, I was making a football movie in Cleveland called Draft Day, and my I was the coach, and my character had really short hair, and I wore he wore sport coats and T-shirts and like slacks with sneakers. And I went outside in this building we were shooting, this hotel, to have a cigarette. And I'm just telling you, I mean, I was surrounded by lesbians. There were like there were lesbians getting off like a lesbian limo bus, and there was a table where lesbians were giving badges to other lesbians. And I was like, what the hell's going on here? And one of them looked over and went, oh, my God. Ellen's here. And everybody flipped out. And it turns out it was Gay Pride weekend was coming up in Cleveland. So everybody was arriving at this hotel. And I really had to say, listen, guys, I'm not Ellen. I'm Dennis Leary. And this one woman was like, Dennis Leary has longer hair. Are you Ellen or not? And I was like, listen, I can't dance. Let me dance and prove to you. And then one of the other ones went, that's not Ellen. That's not, you know.
But, well, that is also part of the cautionary tale here, too. Famous politicians and those who yap about them on all sides of the political aisle, you're not that famous someday.
No, you're not. Yeah, and you know what? It's interesting. The reason I write about fame in the book is because my children, who were millennials, they only knew Donald Trump as a guy that was the star of this television reality show. It's a game changer. Whatever you want to say about Donald Trump, it was a game changer what he did. That's why I say to my Democratic friends, you better start looking for somebody now instead of rage tweeting and find a candidate. Now, the truth is, you might have to go to somebody, you know, like him, somebody famous. I wanted to find out who the Americans consider the most trusted people. The first three people on the list are Tom Hanks, Sandra Bullock, and Denzel Washington. I'm like, these are the most trusted people in America? I mean, we're actors.
You're not the most trusted, and you may not even be the actor people think you are.
I know. Well, in my case, right. I could probably get elected because people would think I was Kevin Bacon.
Dennis Leary, his new book is Why We Don't Suck. Dennis, thank you.
You're welcome, guys.
Later today, President Trump is expected to announce his pick to be the next chair of the Federal Reserve. It's expected to be Jerome Powell, a Republican and a Fed governor since 2012. If confirmed, Powell will take over for the current Fed chair, Janet Yellen, whose four-year term expires in February. The announcement comes just after the Fed wrapped up a two-day policy meeting. Robin Farzad is host of Full Disclosure on NPR One and joins us now with more on this. Hi, Robin.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. And we've been hearing about Jerome Powell over the last few days, but tell us more about him because we'll probably be hearing about him for many years now.
You know, a departure from recent trend, and mind you, this is only the ninth leadership change at the Fed since the end of World War II. So these things don't happen that often. He is not an econ PhD. He's not, you know, an econometrics wonk. He's a private equity maher. He's been on Wall Street. He's actually been nicknamed the Republican Janet Yellen. Everybody is kind of steady as it goes, even now that he's one of the four Fed governors on a seven-seat board, because we're still in the throes of trying to unwind this unprecedented multi-trillion dollar experiment that the right. Fed has engaged in over the past decade.
And is he likely to stay on the same course as Janet Yellen when it comes to interest rates? We learned, you know, yesterday that there's not going to be a raise in interest rates right now, but probably still another one by the end of the year.
He's not known as a hawk or one of these rare remaining ideologues. I mean, sometimes they call them bond vigilantes that are saying, look, we're 9 years into this. We're at a 16-year low in unemployment. Inflation is non-existent. Stock markets that are an all-time high. Real estate is resurging. I mean, Bitcoin is at a record. The problem is there are not enough arrows in the Fed's quiver yet. One of the nice things about hiking rates while the economy is churning along is that you have movement to take rates down when things fall right. apart. If there's an asset bubble that blows up or an LTCM or a, you know, God forbid, a 9/11, and that's the Fed's bind right now. It's really there's no inflation there to give you cushion to ratchet up rates higher so that you could bring them down if something bad happens.
What about on the issue of regulation? Where does he come down there?
On the margins, there's speculation that he might be more inclined to kind of undo the Volcker Rule, which doesn't let Wall Street take risky bets with its money as much. I mean, there was a real puritanical backlash that came after the subprime crash, and we realized that a lot of these Wall Street firms were taking on some real leverage prop trade bets that had the overall economy and the taxpayer on the hook. And there might be more of an appetite to kind of unwind that. There are short memories where that's involved.
When you look at the overall economy right now, a lot of people have been saying for years that the Fed has been propping up the economy. Do you think that that's still the case so many years after the financial crisis?
No doubt, no doubt, especially when you talk about asset markets. There's still a debate. I mean, it's how the other half lives. Stock markets are great. Again, asset markets are great. If you want to sell a business right now, you know, if you've invested in junk bonds and REITs, all of that kind of stuff. The problem is wage growth has not kept up. It's not emboldened companies to go out and hire like crazy and hire with quality jobs. A lot of that is structural and technological, but you're going to see in his Senate confirmation that there are going to be many senators who hold his hand to the fire and say, what can we do to kind of bridge that gap? Overwhelmingly, the Fed's experiment has disproportionately helped the well-to-do.
That's Robin Farzad, who is host of Full Disclosure on NPR One, talking with us about Jerome Powell, who is expected to be named as the next chair of the Federal Reserve, although we don't know until it happens, but we'll see. Robin, thank you.
Jeremy, you are the man.
The fallout from the Harvey Weinstein scandal is spreading, with other men in Hollywood and in media also facing accusations and losing their jobs. Actor Dustin Hoffman has been accused of sexually harassing an intern on a film set in 1985. Filmmaker Tony Montana says he was groped at a bar by actor Kevin Spacey in 2003. And the former senior vice president of news for NPR, Michael Oreskes, resigned yesterday after allegations against him. Across the Atlantic, the UK has a new defense secretary after Sir Michael Fallon resigned over sexual harassment allegations. Now, there are laws in place to protect against sexual harassment and abuse, but how does the legal process work in these cases, and is it fair? Deborah Rohde is a professor of law at Stanford University. She's an expert in gender discrimination law. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much for having me.
And first of all, what is the legal definition of sexual harassment?
Well, there are two forms of sexual harassment. One is what's called quid pro quo harassment, which is exchanging favors for some job opportunity. The other is a hostile environment form of harassment, which is creating a pervasive atmosphere that interferes with work performance.
Is it hard to prove that?
Sex harassment cases have historically been difficult to prove. Oftentimes, there are no witnesses, and the conduct is sometimes seen as trivial. And sometimes a single incident is, but when you have a cumulative pattern, it really creates a corrosive workplace. And sex harassment, despite a quarter century of laws and litigation, still is a very high cause of loss of jobs, job turnover, lack of retention, and social and psychological difficulties resulting from the experience of being in one of those workplaces.
Does it make a difference if the harassment occurs at the office or somewhere else?
Well, if it occurs at the office and the individual has no easy exit alternative, that puts their livelihoods at risk in a way that sex harassment in other contexts doesn't. But certainly sex harassment, for example, in universities can be equally detrimental to jobs and careers and emotional and psychological well-being.
What do you make of all of the allegations that have come out ever since the Harvey Weinstein allegations? Because it does seem like there's a big difference between some of the things that he's accused of and some of the things that other people are being accused of.
Well, sure, it's on a spectrum, and not all of the claims that we're seeing surfacing now look like ones that would probably constitute a hostile environment. But I think it's important to remember that, you know, for centuries, women, especially women, but also men to some extent, have been harassed but had neither a title or a remedy for it. That's finally started to change, and it's changing because I think the culture is finally waking up to the pervasiveness of the problem and the recognition that power and entitlement breeds a form of abuse that can lead, if unchecked, to serial offenders, the Roger Ailes, the Bill O'Reillys, the Harvey Weinsteins. And, you know, it used to be that women rarely were willing to go public with this. And I think we're now seeing a sea change in that view.
Are there risks, though, that with this tsunami of allegations that some people are getting caught up in this, that in some cases the allegations are anonymous, but the accused is not anonymous in the public eye and ends up losing a job right away?
Yeah. Well, you worry a lot about what the effects of unsubstantiated allegations are against public figures. And that's a real downside of what we're seeing, because there's no easy way, oftentimes, with claims that are decades old, for people to assemble proof if, in fact, they haven't engaged in the conduct. And, of course, celebrities have deep pockets and a lot to lose. So the possibility for extortion and exploitation of them is there. But, you know, there's, I think, some natural deterrence to prevent the kind of conduct, because there's always a backlash against people who are seen to be gold diggers and just trumping up some fabricated allegations.
You mentioned Bill O'Reilly from Fox News, who paid $32 million to a colleague at Fox News who's threatened to sue him for alleged sexual misconduct. That was in addition to other settlements that he had paid. How do these settlements come about as a remedy for this?
I think the Bill O'Reilly settlement happened because the complainant in that case, who's someone I know actually, is an extremely good lawyer, probably had collected good documentary evidence and had perfect timing. She waited for a moment when his contract was up for renewal and he was in the midst of a custody battle and had a lot to lose if the allegations went public. So she had enormous leverage in that bargaining. But that's not true of victims in general. And I think one worry about the celebrity cases is that people underestimate how difficult it normally is for victims to win these suits and what the social costs will be from bringing them.
Is there any kind of statute of limitations for accusations? Because many of the accusations we've been hearing about, as you've mentioned, come from decades ago.
There certainly are in courts of law, but in the world of public opinion, not so much. So you can see people losing their jobs for conduct that occurred well before the statute of limitations. They may not have a legal claim, but they have an audience, and the reputational injuries, as we've seen with someone like Kevin Spacey, can be substantial.
How many of these cases do you think are going to end up going to court, and how many are just going to be settled in the court of public opinion?
Rarely are sex harassment cases actually litigated. We know that historically less than 5% of cases get to court, fewer than those are actually litigated. And what normally happens when the cases are filed is they're settled with a confidentiality clause that prevents the victim from disclosing any details. And that's one of the issues that's gotten so much attention with these recent cases, because, of course, the way that perpetrators maintained their power was through settlements that had confidentiality clauses that gagged the victims.
That's Deborah Rohde, who's a professor of law at Stanford University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, the recent allegations of sexual harassment have prompted many to go forward on social media with the hashtag MeToo. Youth Radio spoke with three teens, Hera Mias Arevalo, Sierra Fung Horvath, and Aria Bendy, for their take on the hashtag.
I first heard about the hashtag MeToo from my mother, and she said it's this hashtag that's being used around sexual assault. And that kind of scared me, because I have a lot of female friends that I care deeply about, and I was dreading, you know, going onto social media and finding out that they have also been affected.
Just as in the way it's alarming to see your parents cry, it's alarming to see that the adult world has more flaws than you expected.
The Me Too campaign really opened eyes for me because I have a bunch of little siblings that have to go to public school and I can't be with them all the time to take care of them.
I think it's not just the element of safety. I don't want to just be able to feel physically safe, no matter what I'm doing, who I'm with, what I'm wearing. I want to feel comfortable.
I sometimes go to like parties and things like that with a couple guy friends and a couple female friends. And most of the guys do look out for the girls. And I thought, you know, that's great. What I didn't think about in that moment was telling my guy friends, like, we're protecting this friend, but also make sure that you're not becoming someone who someone needs to be protected from.
You hear the boys will be boys, and then you think, like, oh, they get all their fratty behavior out in college, and then, you know, maybe it sort of trickles off in their mid-20s. But you see, like, these 60- and 70-year-old men being completely inappropriate and absolutely just abusing women in these ways, and you expect this sort of behavior to stop. Well, we're realizing that it never really stops.
As much as being woke is a trend right now, some things we just don't want to talk about. We should definitely take the time to talk to our friends about how we want to be treated and what's the plan if someone wants to take advantage of us in the outside world.
If you are out for Halloween, you may have seen a Wonder Woman or two, maybe a few Batmans, proof that superheroes walk among us. But not just on Halloween. Across the country, anonymous do-gooders are putting on capes and masks and trying to give back to their communities. North Country Public Radio's Lauren Rosenthal has this story from upstate New York.
In the basement of a Methodist church in Canton, New York, the pointy ears on Potsdam Batman's head nearly touch the ceiling. Potsdam is a town about 10 miles away, and its Batman is about 7 feet tall, in black tactical boots, a heavy cape, and a mask. But I'm more focused on his voice.
You know, it's surprisingly not bad. I mean, if I'm using it for 5 or 6 hours straight, I'll get a little bit of soreness. That's it.
Batman isn't alone down here.
I'm Batgirl, Potsdam Batgirl.
There's also a fully corseted Wonder Woman, a newer superhero called Deadpool. And down the hall, a local charity is handing out backpacks full of school supplies to needy kids.
Some people want to have photo ops. Sometimes the children want to interact with us. We're just here to do whatever we can.
When they're not on superhero detail, all these people are just people. There are 11 in all. Some are retired. Some have kids. I know their real names, but the members asked me not to reveal who's actually behind the face paint and masks. The guy who plays Bane, a villain from the Batman franchise, points to a business card the Crusaders made themselves.
It says right on the card, we hide our faces to open our hearts.
To me, if you do something good for other people and you immediately take credit for it, that kind of nullifies it.
It's safe to say that without Batman, the North Country Crusaders wouldn't exist, and neither would a lot of the superhero collectives that have popped up in recent years. Batman has always been Bruce Wayne, a rich guy who hides his identity behind a bat suit to fight crime. But unlike the 60s TV show with its catchy theme song, the new Batman movies carry a really strong message.
It's not who I am underneath, but what I do that defines me.
That idea is what motivated a bored college student in Petaluma, California, to dress up and become Petaluma Batman back in 2013. Here he is riding his scooter in a local TV story.
This caped character has been scooting through the streets of Petaluma on a mission.
There's this motto, a hero can be anyone, and it's kind of really taken a hold of in the newest Batman movies, and I thought, well, that's kind of neat.
Believe it or not, this guy spawned imitators in England, in Canada, and at least a dozen cities across the U.S., including Potsdam, New York.
It's not that Batman is necessarily my favorite fictional character ever, but he was just perfect as a vehicle for what I'm trying to do here.
Well, I knew him before I became Batman. You know, and you get to know somebody and you know that they're you know, not a crazy person.
That's Bob Porter. He's retired now, but he used to work at a craft supply store in Potsdam called Misty Hollow. He remembers when a young guy approached him a few years back and said he wanted to give Potsdam its very own Batman. Porter came around in a pretty big way.
We actually had the Batcave in the basement of the store. he had his makeup and everything. When he had an event, he would walk in the store, sneak into the downstairs into the Batcave, dress up as Batman, and come back out.
Potsdam Batman gave out candy at Halloween, volunteered at local libraries. He was at a charity function when he met another huge superhero fan.
He talked me into being Wonder Woman. So within a month...
I didn't have to talk you into anything.
I had she says, I had the cape and I had a little bit of a costume.
Yes, he says, I didn't know that we had a Batman. And I've got this Wonder Woman costume. I said, I didn't know we had a Wonder Woman. That's how much I had to talk you into it.
Yeah, I know. It doesn't take much.
The North Country Crusaders has grown from two heroes into nearly a dozen, and they've gotten a lot more polished, handing out business cards, starting a Facebook page. This summer, they performed for nearly 16,000 people at a minor league baseball game in Buffalo.
And we'll be here. We are together.
We're always seeking new ways. Mm-hmm. You know, how can we volunteer? What can we do that uses, you know, our characters and connecting those characters to the faces out there? How can we reach people?
But Potsdam Batman says the group's bread and butter is always going to be showing up whenever they're called upon. Back at Canton's Methodist Church, sisters Lily LaFave and Emma France mistake Deadpool for Spider-Man, and they totally freeze up when Wonder Woman tries to hand them free granola bars with their school supplies. Mom Kirstie Murphy says this isn't their first sighting.
We've seen them a few times around town. They're really great.
Yeah, we saw them at, we saw Batman and Batgirl and those other guys at, what do you call it again?
Park.
The park.
Yeah, the one across from Heritage. Pretty bizarre, but it was cool.
In other words, if a kid wants to find a hero these days, they don't have to look all that hard. For Here and Now, I'm Lauren Rosenthal in Canton, New York.
I am going to start wearing a cape. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. You're 2 days late. That should have been perfect for Halloween. This is Here and Now.